on ABC Radio New South Wales. This is the Country Hour.
Good afternoon, David Claughton with you, and on the program today, how people are coping with the heat. We'd love to hear from you, 0467 922 684. It's not all bad. One winemaker says it's helping him to produce a pretty good drop.
We're making a slightly bigger style of white wine. On the broader perspective, they're still quite fine, elegant wines, but for our usual style, they are a little bit more richly fruited. And then the red wines, you know, just generally speaking, I think we're making some of the most wonderful red wines that I've ever made.
And some people, the heat's driven them to jumping in the sheep's water trough. More from you shortly. Send us your SMS. It's a bit of a theme over this week. It has been ferociously hot. 0467 922 684. We hope to bring you more on the story in the Daily Telegraph today, looking at allegations that Animals Australia worked with whistleblowers on the Awasi Express and paid them for some of the vision that we saw last year on 60 Minutes of sheep suffering. There are some legal issues around that coverage. We'll do our best to bring that story to you today. And we will also talk about a booming almond industry. But first, let's have a little look at the heat conditions. And farmers in the New England West Northwest are finding all sorts of ways to keep cool as the temperature gets as high as 42 degrees in that area. Ross Taylor is on a property at Kentucky on the Tablelands, and he finds that the sheep's water trough is a pretty handy source of relief. Speaking to Lara Webster.
It was hot. I was buggery and leaving the sheep around, and I thought, why not jump in? And so the sheep came up and had a bit of a look, but it was good. They just had to wait. I wasn't in there too long.
Yeah, I was going to say, was it too long a break for from work or just a quick reprieve?
Yeah, I probably stayed on there for 5 minutes, did an email. And
good to know you were still working from the water trough there. Tell me about the sheep now. I did speak to someone who's got some Dorpers and said they're actually not handling the heat too well at the moment. How are your sheep handling things?
Knocking them around a bit, like especially, you know, little weaners and stuff like that. We've done early weaning and stuff like that, so everything's pretty much in the shade, and all that sort of any green pick we had all disappeared. So that's the way it goes. You know, I think these hot days are sort of the norm now rather than out of the ordinary. So just have to get used to it, I think. Mm.
And owners are occasionally in troughs by the sounds of things.
Yeah, why not? I went to a spa in Scotland, and it was a seaweed bath, and it's pretty similar to that, like, I reckon.
Ross Taylor speaking there. Meantime, David Quince runs a Dorper operation at Tambor Springs near Gunnedah on the northwest slopes. Temperatures in the district have been up to or above 40 degrees, and although his Dorpers are bred for the hot, tough conditions, even they are struggling. And unfortunately, they can't go for a sit in the trough like Ross Taylor.
Even they are feeling the heat and stressed out by it. About the only good thing about this heat is that it probably reduces the food intake that they require to maintain their body weights, because it's so hot. They're camped for most of the day and really only browse early in the morning and late in the evening. But these sheep, they're unlike any other sheep. They're a bit like cattle. They'll actually immerse themselves in a dam or swim across a dam. Unfortunately, we've got normally about 26 dams on this place, and I think there's only two to three that actually are holding water at the moment.
And obviously in this heat, as you mentioned, they're not eating a great deal, but they need much more water than they usually would. So with not a great deal of water around, how are you trying to keep the water consumption up to them?
Well, we're lucky enough that we've got a reliable well here, and we're able to source a very reliable source and constant source of water, which I reticulate.
How are you and your family handling the conditions as you try to continue with the work that has to be done?
Well, it's very simple. You just start very early in the morning and knock off when it becomes too intense, and then start again later in the evening. But obviously, the time frame you've got reduces your work hours, and obviously at a time like this, feeding stock and doing stuff and just maintaining it, you're hard pushed to get everything done while these sort of conditions are occurring. I mean, I've spent a lot of time in my younger days up in the Territory in Queensland, and the heat that we're getting down here now is, I feel, even more intense than I experienced up there.
David Quince speaking there to Lara Webster. It's an interesting observation, isn't it? I wonder if you feel like that too, how intense is the heat that you're experiencing at the moment. And a reminder, if you're concerned about your stock, the local Land Services vet team can assist. We had a picture sent to us by Chris, who's travelling at the moment, and he sent a couple of pictures of some irrigation, flood irrigation actually, for cotton. He said it was 37 degrees outside St. George. This is on the 14th of this month. And he observed more water flowing through that irrigation channel than he'd seen at Moonee Weir in the Condamine. And I think he says the Meadie Rivers. Not sure where that is, Chris. But thanks for that. But I imagine this is the time that some of those key crops that are worth quite a lot of money need to be irrigated. Love to have your thoughts on that. 0467 922 684. On the Country Hour, it's 11 past 12. And let's see. The hot weather is expected to delay the wine grape harvest around Griffith, with temperatures exceeding 40 degrees there this week. Leaves and berries are showing some signs of sunburn. Verity Gorman spoke to the Wine Grapes Marketing Board Chief Brian Simpson, who says the extent of the damage there won't be evident until harvest.
Once temperatures reach above around 35 to 36 degrees, the grapevines actually stop transpiring. So they won't photosynthesise. You won't see the steady conversion of starches into sugars that we normally get around this late period in the season. And what I have concerns for is this will delay the start of harvest. And wineries are well aware of that, and they're actually organising their staffing requirements now for probably we'll be getting the full swing early February.
So when do you normally start? How much will it be delayed by?
It's been getting earlier and earlier over the last five, six seasons, and I'm not sure what that's to do with, whether it's a change in seasons, growers with more blocks having to prune earlier, therefore the grapes are coming on earlier. But it's probably more back to traditional periods where we've got the grapes maturing in that February period. January, they start and pick a few of the earlier varieties for sparkling and champagne-based style wines and Moscatos. But we're now seeing that go back to where it was many years ago, and I think that's probably a good thing.
When you say many years, when would the last time have been that you would have had harvest at, a bit later?
I'd say about 6 years ago. I think we've just seen it coming forward, marching forward earlier every year since. So this is gets us back to a normal period. But what it's likely to do, it's going to create the intake issues at the winery. We will see what we call a compressed vintage, where if we get this return back to normal conditions, weather conditions, we'll see all grapes starting to mature close to each other, which means processing problems can arise where you've got one variety that's ready to pick and the other one's coming in and they just compress on top of each other. And it makes it logistically challenging at all the various processing facilities in the region.
With these hot temperatures that we've been having, has water use been pretty high?
Water use is very high. We've had minimal rainfall this growing season, which has been great for keeping a check on disease. Growers have reported minimal incidences of anything out in the vineyard. So the grapes are looking very clean at the moment, but water use is high. And if you've got a drip irrigation system, they've been pumping them fiercely. Water prices are actually spiking at the moment, with reports of temporary water around the $600 per megalitre. So hopefully growers have got enough water in their accounts to finish off the season.
What about any issues with sunburn on, leaves and fruit? What are you seeing there?
Well, sunburn can be problematic, and it's a lot of to do with the temperature and the wind burn too. We're lucky, though, that we have good canopies, and that keeps the grapes actually shaded. But it's apparent when some vineyards where there's a bit of water stress, we're seeing leaf burn, and you're getting, berries that are exposed to the sun are getting a bit of a mark on them, and that can impact on wine quality. And we're hoping that that's minimal out there, and we're hoping that wineries are actually mindful of that and take steps not to penalise growers excessively this season because it's something that's out of their control.
When will you know whether this hot weather has had any negative impacts?
Well, I think once we get the first variety out of the way, which is generally Chardonnay, we'll have an idea whether the crop's down. Growers were reporting we're on track for a good to above average yield this season, and reports from members coming through now is that average to below average. The berries are there, but they're just not sizing up. Mother Nature would be good. A bit of rainfall helps push a bit of moisture into the berries and helps freshen up the vines, gets the dust off the leaves and allows them to transpire and photosynthesise more easily.
What are those conditions that you need over the next few weeks? What would be the ideal scenario?
Oh, low 30s as a maximum would be ideal. That's good growing conditions. And then, you know, what we have concerns, if these conditions continue and you've got these above 25, 26 and even above 30s at night, it limits harvesting timing and you know, the energy use requirement at wineries would go through the roof if they have to start cooling fruit that comes in. We need the cooler daytime temperatures would also benefit growers because then they can actually harvest during the daytime as well as picking in the cooler periods at night, and that's that benefits everyone through the supply chain because we can manage the process of harvesting easier and a lot safer.
That was Wine Grapes Marketing Board Chief Executive Officer Brian Simpson on the Country Hour. It's 17 past 12. And oranges, cool climate wines, are growing in reputation and popularity, but weather like this that we're experiencing this week is not what you'd expect in a cool climate. Daniel Shaw is the senior winemaker at Philip Shaw Winery, where they were bottling yesterday. And Sally Bryant was there. She asked Daniel just how high the mercury had risen.
I think about 38 or 39, which is, you know, I guess on a regular basis, doesn't happen very often.
Now, cool climate wine, and it's 38 and 39 degrees.
Well, it's nice to think that you're at the beach every now and then, and it feels a little bit more like that, you know, but there's no sort of afternoon cooling sea breeze. Cool climate wine, you know, I guess you look at the overall sort of average temperatures to kind of decide whether you're cool climate or not. So we still fit into that category, but we are, you know, I would say for the last 3 years, we're getting regular heat spikes. So we probably had three or at least two, you know, hot periods last year. You know, it is really very rare for orange to get into the high 30s. And last year we got to 40. So yeah, it is definitely different for us. You know, are we making better or worse wines? You know, that's, I guess, arguable, but, you know, especially for red wine, I think it's actually helping us make better red wines.
What has the greatest impact? Is it the maximum temperature during the day, or is it also a question of not coming down to a minimum overnight?
Well, I think the minimum temperature is really important for acid retention. So, you know, with cool climate wines, you are really looking for wines that have a freshness to them. And a big part of that freshness is the natural acidity and the bright fruit flavours as well. So as long as we do still get cooler nighttime temperatures, we don't have the acidity degraded too much in the fruit. And then, you know, on the hotter side or the daytime temperatures, as long as we're not getting sunburn, then we're not necessarily damaging the flavours. At this period where we're at now, which is Verizon, or before Verizon, the berries are still quite hard, and they're only really just starting to develop their flavours and that type of thing. So, you know, as long as we don't get sunburn, I'm not actually too worried about it.
The sunburn study that's going on around orange at the moment, how hopeful are you that that's going to turn around something that's going to be really useful for you to manage the sunburn in your grapes?
I think it's got potential for sure. You know, what I've learnt with sunburn over the last couple of years is it's like almost everything else in agriculture. It's totally unpredictable. So you put all of this work in to figure out a way to help something that's happened in the past, and then another
something
event
else will happen.
Happens totally differently. And, you know, one year the eastern side of the vine might get a little bit of sunburn, and then the next year it happens on the western side. So I guess we are trying to adapt, though. We are trying to become better viticulturalists in these warmer cycles or periods. Or
now let's talk about rain. How have you fared in the last 6 to 12 months with rainfall?
You know, I'd probably extend it a little bit further than that and say 18 months. You know, we've been, you know, I don't have any stats, but we've been very dry. You know, we had the driest winter on record, I think, last year, 2017. 18, you know, we have had a little bit more rain, but it's still significantly dry. You know, we did get moisture down into the soil profile. But again, now it's really quite dry. You know, we're in a, I would say, a reasonably fortunate situation in that we don't normally irrigate our vineyard. But it is nice to be able to irrigate it during these heat waves.
Daniel Shaw, senior winemaker at Philip Shaw Winery, on his experience with the hot conditions in a cool climate wine area.
The Country Hour on ABC Radio New South Wales.
Had a text from one of my colleagues at the DPI saying they have a long-term Country Hour listener called Katie, whose birthday it is today. Congratulations, Katie. And we got an SMS from LF saying, it's in the heat conditions and how people keep cool and having a drink. There's a parallel, he reckons, between kava and idleness. It's a joke in Germany that the water in the olden days was undrinkable. People drank spirits instead, and then they couldn't work in the afternoons because they got sozzled. When beer was introduced to the English, he says, they became productive because they could work and drink almost all day. Not sure how that fits into your working day routine. And I was speaking to a farmer the other day who says he's not working at all in the afternoons at the moment. 0467 922 684 is our SMS. A glut in blueberries has producers looking at alternatives at the moment. It's the traditional time of the year when higher production occurs, and prices are also down for blueberry producers. A possible alternative for all that fruit is to make blueberry wine. Bargo Winery, which is near Port Macquarie on the mid-north coast, has about 2 tonnes of blueberry seconds. That's the fruit that hasn't maybe gone to market. And Michael Kavanagh caught up with the owner, Jim Mobbs, as they were bottling a port in one part of his winery.
We've designated one bin for a full-bodied red, another bin a lighter style. It'll be winemaking technique how we change those differences, because the base is basically the same. And then we've got another bin we're going to do into a fortified or a blueberry liqueur, that style. So it'll be much more alcohol, maybe use it as a mixer drink. We don't know yet.
Well, the one that's directly in front of us, that's the one that you've got looking at the red. There's a bit of a contradiction here, isn't it? The fact that they're blueberries, but you're talking about a red wine.
In the past, I've made blueberries in brandy spirits and fermented them, and all the brandy goes really basically black. You can't see the blueberries in them. It's not going to be red at all, and it's not going to be blue, it's just going to be black.
The one in the middle, you're talking about that possibly being a rosé, and then you said of using wine techniques. Even though it's got that rich, lush, almost black look about it now, you could possibly end up with that looking like a lighter red or like a rosé.
I'm not sure whether it will actually look lighter, but if we don't fully ferment them on the skins and take them off early and then finish the fermentation off in another vat without the skins, we're expecting to not get so many tannins and anthocyanins coming out because we've taken the skins off, so the wine itself will be a lighter style.
Talking to your winemaker, Greg, and he said, oh look, we just went in, had a bit of a look at Google, worked out what could be done. Is there much of a difference in making wine from blueberries to the more traditional grape?
Looking at all the historical data, there's hardly any difference at all between blueberries and grapes, except for grapes have a much higher sugar content, natural sugar content. For example, we pick grapes that were around the 14 Beaumet. These only came in really ripe at 6 Beaumé. 1 Beaumé is equivalent to 1% alcohol.
That would mean, therefore, that the so-called red blueberry wine and the rosé and even the fortified, which is in the third bin, the alcohol content, would you be expecting that to be lower than if you were making a Shiraz from your own grapes?
What we've done is add some grape juice concentrate, so we've brought the sugar level up. The one that's going to a fortified has got a much higher natural sugar level. The lighter style is going to have a lower. As long as we have it over 8%, it's classified as a wine and we don't have excise on it.
You can see they're very much still in the breaking down stage. They're very identifiable as blueberries. The process, do they break down about the same pace as what you'd expect of your grapes?
These have been here for a couple of days and they're taking a little bit longer. We've actually had a pectin additive to it to help break down the pectinase in it, so it'll help break it down. We're not sure how long it's going to take. Right now they're looking more like small grape berries.
Alcohol is all about fermentation and the sugar and that sort of thing. Have you noticed though already, and I've got the plunger, and if I push that in and you can see the juice is starting to come out as it goes to the bottom, yeah, and the grape, do you expect much of a difference in the technique and bottling than you would with the more traditional one?
Not in the bottling and that. Once we get the fermented wine out, what we're not sure about is the extraction rate. How much in grapes, we'd expect a 70 to 75% extraction rate. So if you get a tonne of juice, you expect 750 mils of wine. That's first up, not after filtering and everything. Expect the extraction rate to be less.
Once you've done that, you put them in the barrel like a normal wine. Any idea how long you'd leave them in the barrel before it gets to the bottling stage?
Not at this stage. We just have to have a look at it. The fortifieds, I'd like to leave it as long as we can. And the lighter style, we'd probably try and get in the bottle fairly quickly, but we'll go and taste it. It might be terrible.
We've got dandelion wine. People have tried banana wine. They're all shockers. Why do you think this one's going to work?
We didn't say it was going to work. There's an oversupply already. There's going to be a big surplus on the North Coast. If we do the research now and find out whether it is going to work or it's not going to work, it'll help out the industry. It'll give us some more fill-in time. This is happening not in our busiest time, so we can keep things going. And it's all going to do due to marketing. I suspect it'll come out quite nice. We're getting another couple of tonne in this week again, and we're going to put it all into fortified because I think that's where the market will be.
And that's talking to blueberry winemaker. Well, that's what he might become known as now, Jim Mobbs, who's experimenting with blueberries as an alternative source of fruit to make wine. And there might be others following in that footpath in the recent and the next few months, given that there's such an excess of blueberries around at the moment. We will go and talk to the Weather Bureau shortly and hear from the news headlines in a second. But while we're thinking about the hot weather, it's worth considering how vulnerable native species are coping. The conditions are taking their toll on them as well. And there are some things that we can all do to help them survive. Tim Hoskins is a member of the Dubbo Field Naturalists. He told Sally Bryant there are some very simple measures that can go a long way, even in your back garden, to helping out native species.
The whole landscape takes a hit in these conditions, and the birds are part of that and relying on food sources and water sources from it. So, yeah, they can use a bit of help from us.
So what sorts of things can we do? Because we're often told that intervening with native species can actually be a bigger problem than a benefit.
Yeah, there are mixed messages there. I think just generally, a small water source doesn't hurt anything, really. So things like finches, they need to drink every day to digest their grain food. So you can help by providing those bird feeders and bird the watering points. The feeding's probably a bit more tricky. You don't want to attract the wrong type of customers to your place, and you are sort of changing the natural web of food and dependence there. So I guess that's a bit more tricky to do, but certainly water goes a long way to helping birds. A lot of birds will use shade in these circumstances too, so providing maybe safe shade where cats and dogs don't pester them would be helpful.
So let's say it's a stinking hot day and I see a little bird in my back garden sitting on the ground, obviously heat distressed. What should I be doing with it?
Depends how heat distressed, I suppose. If it's distressed enough to pick up and things, then it's got a real problem. And so it's usually a matter of putting it straight in a quiet box, and maybe you then consider calling WIRES or other animal rescue organisation. Of course, some of us aren't near town, don't have that opportunity, so it's usually a matter of providing quiet space, because it will get stressed as soon as people go near it and pick it up. So how does it deal with that stress, and providing water for it? And sometimes they recover, sometimes not.
What about other native species? Do they really feel the heat? Or being native, do they just go, oh, suck it up, mate, you know, this is where we live?
Yeah, no. No, they all suffer, and people will see that, you know, as kangaroos and wallabies and things go to extra lengths to find food and water. Often they're drinking more than normal, so they're exposing themselves to risk, you know, from predators and people just to get those food and water sources. So I guess in these conditions we've just all got to be a bit mindful, and if having those critters around are important to you, then yeah, giving them a bit more space and leeway than normal would be great.
That's Tim Hosking, who's a member of the Dubbo Field Naturalist, talking about what we can do to help the native animals. And we had a text from Bob in Armidale saying, I've set a big fan up outside our kitchen window, and as soon as it's cooler outside than inside at night, I open up all the windows with fly screens fitted and blow cool air into our house at night and then shut it up in the morning. He says, please try to help your native animals through this man-made drought. 0467 922 684 is our SMS if you want to contribute to the conversation. And let's hear what's happening in the wider news. Good afternoon, David Marchese.
G'day, David. In the news this afternoon, British Prime Minister Theresa May has started talks with other party leaders on the way ahead for Brexit after surviving a no-confidence vote. Mrs. May says she's committed to honouring the wishes of the British people and take the UK out of the European Union. The Rural Fire Service says 45 blazes are burning across New South Wales as a heatwave continues. 18 are yet to be contained. 260 firefighters are working to bring them under control. The State Transport Minister Andrew Constance is defending a plan that could lead to some train maintenance jobs moving from Sydney to the Central West. Mr. Constance says no jobs will be lost. Under the plan, a depot would be built at Dubbo. And in the tennis, two Australians play second round matches at the Australian Open in Melbourne today. Wildcard entrant Alex Bolt meets Frenchman Gilles Simon, while another wildcard, Alexei Popran, is up against Austrian Dominic Thiem. And Dave, more ABC News coming up at 1.
Tennis is fascinating. Watched one of the games last night. I couldn't see it to the end, though, but it was a great contest with one of the Australians, Stiminor, there. And
it's always a battle with the tennis. I mean, it can drag on into the wee hours.
That's right. And we had a fascinating discussion yesterday with our own business unit.
Yeah.
We went down there to say we'd reported on the Brexit thing and how it's looking like a train crash over there, because if they don't have a deal, you know, their farmers actually won't be able to export all their manufacturing sector. They'll just have to stop on that March 29th date.
It's huge, huge implications across nearly every sector. And I know that the agriculture sector is looking really closely at this, because there are going to be some real consequences. Yeah. So,
90% of their beef goes to the EU.
Right, yeah.
Anyway, the conversation went all about UK politics and why they can't seem to make a decision or agree on a plan. It was fascinating.
Yeah.
Thanks for that.
No worries.
David Marchese from the newsroom. And we've been trying to set up a good line between us and the Bureau today, and I was just to see if that's working. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
No, there's some problem with that. So I'm going to call the Bureau back on the telephone line in a moment, and we'll cover the weather on the telephone line in a few minutes. So bear with us while we sort that problem out. And Australia's almond industry is booming, set for another record harvest this year. Early crop forecasts estimate growers will harvest an extra 13,000 tonnes, resulting in a total national crop of 93,000. CEO of the Almond Board of Australia, Ross Skinner, says the demand for all kinds of nuts is still rising on the global market.
Well, the overall industry position looks like it will be a record crop for us for the 2019 season. We did have some early damage to the crop from hail and also wind damage, but overall the yields are looking very strong.
And if you are saying we are expecting to see another record crop, how much are we expecting to see come off the trees nationwide?
Well, the early estimates provided to us from the industry processors is for a crop of around about 93,000 tonnes, which is about 13,000 tonnes more than the industry grew in 2018, and we had plateaued for the previous 4 years around that 80,000 tonne mark.
And why is it that we are seeing another record crop?
Well, we have seen a lot of the orchards maturing. So over a period of 6 or 7 years, the trees reach full maturity, and a lot of the plantings that have occurred are now starting to fill the orchard rows and reach maturity. So the crop size has now increased. We have, over the last couple of years, seen significant crop losses during the growing season. So we're really starting in 2019 to see the true potential of the orchards that are planted.
And Ross, as the almond industry has been growing quite quickly over the last years in Australia, what are some of the challenges growers in the industry face currently?
From a marketing perspective, the increased tonnage will look to be sold on export markets, and at the moment there's very strong demand for Australian products as a result of the free trade agreements that are in place in a lot of the Asian countries, and also Australian products are very popular in India and Europe. Some of the challenges posed by the increase in the orchard area for almonds is accessing pollination services. So we're looking at increasing the number of hives required to pollinate the crop. And there's also the challenge of finding suitable labour when we've seen such an increase in orchard area. I think from 2016 to 2018, we've seen 12,000 additional hectares added to the industry acreage. And then there's the other inputs are also in higher demand, so things like fertiliser and also water is another key input.
As you've mentioned there, that demand for Australian almonds is quite high, especially from Asian countries. Can Australian growers at the moment meet demand?
Australia is only a small player by comparison to the US industry. The Californians produce about 80% of world production. Australia is the second biggest world producer at 7% of world production, followed by Spain at around about 5 to 6%. We are in a position, even though we're the second largest, we still only supplying a small amount to export markets by comparison to the US. So at the moment, we're certainly not having carryover stock from year to year, so we are managing to find a home for all the production. And world demand for nuts in general and almonds in particular is increasing rapidly. So we've seen a doubling of supply in the world over the last 15 or so years.
Riverland almond grower Paul Martin says this year's crop looks quite promising.
It's been, without trying to sound too down market, it's been a pretty average year for us. No big problems. Bit of wind early on young trees, which caused some broken limbs. And now we're in the middle of a fairly hot period, which is challenging for keeping the irrigation water up.
What does the crop look like?
Well, the crop looks average to good, and the pollinators in particular would probably be above average. The main variety, we're not too sure, but at least average. So, we're pretty happy with the way it's looking.
And as global demand for almonds is still rising, grower Paul Martin says he's never seen the nuts sell as quickly as they did last year.
Demand's been very good. I know our market has sold the 2018 crop quite early, and which I've never seen it move that quickly before. So the price has been good and the market's strong. It's compared a little bit by the tariff wars between China and USA, but I don't think it's a major effect. China's only probably 8% of the US market, so it's not a huge influence.
That's Riverland almond grower Paul Martin speaking to Jessica Schremer about the rapid growth in the almond crop. 0467 922 684 is our SMS. We had a message from Mark at Grassy Head talking about the water. He says the water in Beardmore Dam near St George in Queensland should be on a one-way ticket to recharge Lake Pamamaru at Menindi. There's still tens of tons. There's still a lot of native fish stock alive there, he reckons, but their time is limited as their water evaporates and heats up. He says the Minister Blair talks about restocking, but the fish are already there and trapped, and sounds like he'd like to see some action in moving some of that water through the system to Menindi Lakes. We weren't able to get to the Weather Bureau a short time ago on our usual line, so Ashley Lange joins me now on the telephone. Good afternoon, Ashley.
Good afternoon.
What's happening with the weather today?
Yeah, so today we expect some thunderstorms through the majority of the state, with the exception of the central and northern coastlines, and more likely in the southeast of the state today. And again, really warm temperatures, particularly through the west, where we're already seeing low 40s.
And what's the outlook for the next few days?
Yeah, so tomorrow we're looking, that trough moves a bit through to the central parts of the state, so we expect storms and showers to extend from the northwest to the southeast of the state tomorrow, and potentially some severe thunderstorms again in the southeast of the state.
And the nearest sign of a change, what do you reckon?
Yeah, so we do expect a change to come through Saturday. And temperatures will drop slightly through Saturday through to Sunday, but then by next Wednesday we're up again to 40 degrees.
And there's no rain coming, is there?
We expect some rain in the southeastern districts, most likely, and then central and eastern districts from Sunday to Monday.
Okay, how much?
We're not looking at much, from 0 to 3 millimetres.
Okay, so pretty much what you were talking about a few days ago.
Yeah.
Alrighty, any warnings?
We do have warnings current. We have a fire weather warning for the southern ranges, central ranges, northwest, the lower central west plains, southern slopes, eastern Riverina and the ACT. So be vigilant.
Mm. Thanks for that.
Thank you.
Ashley Lange at the Bureau of Meteorology. There are quite a lot of fires, which we heard about in the news headlines, but none of them are major fires yet. We'll keep watching the RFS website. And if you are in any of those areas, it might be worth keeping your eye on that page as well for any details of fires that get worse and might require some action in your area. Richard says on the text line, why is there no major story on Animals Australia paying low-paid workers to deliberately distress animals in transit overseas? Getting very cynical of the country, our agenda these days, says Richard. Well, we haven't run that story yet because we have been working to verify the allegations. And I suppose that's why the ABC sometimes runs behind some other major broadcast outlets, because we want to verify the story before we actually run it. But we do have a report on that, which we'll play shortly. And to the dairy issue now and the situation in the UK with Brexit. Farmers there say they're trying to prepare their businesses as best they can if no Brexit deal is reached before the March 29 deadline to cut ties with the EU. At Westminster overnight, Prime Minister Theresa May narrowly survived a vote of no confidence against her government. Robert Martin is a dairy farmer based in Cumbria in the north of England. He told Larissa Smith, it's a precarious situation.
We're only 70 days off Brexit over here. And we're told that the majority of Parliament wish to avoid a no deal. But to me, it still remains a distinct possibility because it hasn't been taken off the table of any of the Brexit exit policies.
So what's the best scenario from this point onwards?
For as far as I'm concerned, as a dairy farmer, I would like to see a deal put together so that I have tariff-free access to my marketplace, because the last thing I want to do is to have tariffs imposed on my exports and no tariffs imposed on the imports, because no government is going to allow food prices to rise for its voters.
Will that naturally happen if no deal is reached before the March deadline?
We leave on the 29th of March, and if there is no deal in place on the 29th, then we exit with no deal, and it's a real possibility that we will see export tariffs imposed on our products and no import tariffs on the products coming in to the UK. And the last thing I want to do is for the British consumer to be reliant on overseas imports, which are many produced to lower standards than we produce here. And the thought of, if you look through the tariff numbers at the moment, if you export chicken, that'll be a 27% tariff, lamb will be 46%, and beef will be 65%. It'll put most of those sectors out of business quite quickly.
Is the general population worried about having food shortages?
It's only within a generation that my parents remembered the food embargoes coming over from the food coming in from America for World War II, because we didn't have enough food to feed our nation here. So it's in the memory of the older generation. And they always told us that we have to try to keep up the production of food in the UK so that we don't run short. And I think it's a perilous position for any parliamentarian to put us in that position again.
What about changes to the free movement of EU migrants? I know the UK really depends on these migrants for an agricultural workforce. How do you think that's going to play out?
Well, at the moment, if you look at the numbers projected for 2019, we need in excess of 10,000 seasonal workers for the UK. And if we lose those, then we will end up with fruit and vegetables unpicked in the fields. A large number of the dairy farmers in my part of the world, in Cumbria, in north of England, they rely on Eastern European labour to milk their cows. They will not come, or they will not get a licence to come, because they will not be down as important high-skilled labour people, which, to be honest with you, anybody who milks cows or works for livestock, it is quite highly skilled.
So do you think this is critical in the negotiations, that there is some sort of allowance for migrants to work in agricultural industries?
I don't think it's at the top of their agenda. I can see it being higher for doctors and nurses and other people in care work, but I cannot see it being the top of the agenda for agriculture. They don't seem to appreciate how important it is to us.
How can you plan your season with so much uncertainty over the next 10 weeks?
Well, that's the $64,000 question, isn't it? As far as I'm concerned here, as a dairy farmer, I spoke with my cooperative last week, who are Arla, to see what they are going to do and put plans in place. And they tell me that they have the plans in place for each of the scenarios. We don't know what they are yet, because I don't think they're prepared to share them. But they will do whatever they can to try to protect the income of their owners. And that's going to be a huge issue. But as far as I'm concerned here, I have to make sure that I try to keep my costs down as much as I can, try to maximise my income. People seem to forget that 25% of the world volume of Arla comes from the UK, and the UK is 25% of their world sales. So it's a huge, important customer to Arla. And the last thing they want to do is have wagons stuck on either side of the sea, the channel, whatever we wish to be, and find that they can't get their trucks into the country with their products on board. The last thing you want to do is have products going off, waiting for a check to get them into the UK.
Especially milk.
Absolutely so. We know it's a short shelf life on it, and it's not good.
UK dairy farmer Robert Martin in Cumbria, I think that's how they pronounce it, speaking to Larissa Smith on the Country Hour. It's 12 to 1.
Hi, I'm Lisa. I'm a dairy farmer, and when I'm milking the cows, I like listening to the Country Hour.
We were talking almonds earlier, and someone's texted in. Good to put your name on these texts, by the way. We still haven't been told how much water these nut trees use. Seems to be okay to blame cotton and rice for destroying the rivers, but all these nuts are on the bottom end of the river system getting plenty of water. You have to be wary about those annual crops. Like, people have invested a lot of money to plant trees, waited quite a long time for them to mature and produce a crop, and they are paying a lot of money often for high security water. So these things have to be weighed up. It's, you know, if you were a small businessman and you built up your business over many years, and sometimes someone changed the goalposts, the government, for example, it would be deeply distressing. So let's keep that in mind when we're discussing the water issue. To live exports now, and farmers are calling for a review of how footage showing sheep suffering on a live export vessel, arguably the catalyst for a major campaign to end the trade, originally came to public attention. Kath Sullivan has more.
Animals Australia has defended the whistleblower who exposed footage from a live export ship that brought significant national attention to its campaign to ban live exports. In a statement to the ABC today, it said,
"The indisputable evidence of animal abuse obtained by whistleblower Mr. Faisal Allah was corroborated by other workers from the Awassi Express who were similarly concerned about the suffering of animals on the vessel. The overwhelming evidence of suffering across five voyages, confirmed in end-of-voyage vet reports, was accepted by industry associations and government regulators."
Animals Australia said it would not comment further while a criminal justice investigation was underway, except to say,
"We reserve all of our rights with respect to any allegations made, defamatory or otherwise."
The statement comes as News Corp newspapers raised doubts about the way footage was obtained, leading farmers to call for a new investigation. WA Farmers Federation spokesman Steve Maguire.
Animals Australia denied that they were paying people for footage.
Last December, the ABC reported that government backbencher Barnaby Joyce had used parliamentary privilege to claim a live sheep export whistleblower was paid around $200,000. The footage showing sheep deaths on board a live export ship headed to the Middle East led to fierce debate about whether the industry should be shut down. Animals Australia was provided with the vision, which was published by 60 Minutes program in April. Speaking to the Parliament on December 5, the former Deputy Prime Minister said the whistleblower was paid but did not say by who.
Where was the person who was responsible for looking after them? Well, he was the person who took the footage. He was the person who took the footage. And now he sold the footage, he's been paid, and he's living happily in Pakistan. I think he's got in excess of $200,000 for it.
Animals Australia had denied it or 60 Minutes provided any payment for the footage. Mr Joyce's comments to the Parliament came during the same week that exporters announced a self-imposed ban on the live export of sheep during the northern summer next year. This morning, Deputy Prime Minister Michael McCormack gave his support for the live export trade.
We as Nationals and we as the government stand behind those people who are exporting sheep and exporting animals generally in a responsible and the proper way, using the proper channels and with animal welfare front and centre of everything that they do.
And that report by Kath O'Sullivan on the live export question that's been in the media today. 0467 922684 is our SMS. And I have spoken with Barnaby Joyce's office and asked them to supply whatever evidence they've got on that topic of the emails between Animals Australia and the crew on board the Awasi Express. We haven't received anything from them as yet. And on the country, our former Greens and now Independent MP Jeremy Buckingham has added his voice to criticisms of the management of the Murray-Darling Basin. Mr Buckingham has been meeting with Darling River communities in recent months and says they feel disenfranchised, that their concerns are not being heard. He told the ABC's Lucy Thackray that the pastoralists in the region are unhappy with how the state and federal governments have managed the system.
It's clear that the graziers along the Murray-Darling Basin systems want a restoration of the small to medium-sized floods. What we're seeing is a boom-bust cycle. There's floods, they get out into the system, but they're very infrequent. The more routine floods, the small and medium-sized floods, are being gobbled up by the big irrigators in southern Queensland and northern New South Wales. And the big losers from that are the graziers, flood-prone graziers. They're the ones that depend on that inundation from time to time and our ecology. It depends on it as well. So wherever I go, people want a restoration of that regime and they want some of those allocations that have been snapped up by people such as Webster's out in the west bought back so we get a restoration in our riverine systems.
Where to from here? What needs to take place now given there is such little water in the system?
Well, we just got to hope and pray that we get rain. That's the only thing that's really going to save the system as it is. We are expecting other fish kills, which have just been absolutely horrendous. But what we need is a Royal Commission into the management of the Murray-Darling Basin, the Murray-Darling Basin Authority, and who's been doing what at a state level to undermine a sustainable Murray-Darling Basin plan. We've spent $13.5 billion. $13.5 billion, $13,500 million on the Murray-Darling Basin plan, and it is an absolute smoking ruin. We need politicians held to account for that. The best way is through a Royal Commission, and that's something I'm campaigning on up to the state election.
The Federal Member for Parks, Mark Coulton, has called people or politicians calling for a Royal Commission political grandstanding. What do you have to say to that?
Well, where has Mark Coulton been? He's been absolutely missing in action. I haven't seen him out on the Darling River. I haven't seen him saying anything. This has been a slow-moving disaster, and Mark Coulton has been in hiding. The National Party are too caught up in their own scandals. They're too caught up in doing the bidding for their big irrigator donor mates, and Mark Coulton is absolutely absolutely missing in action on this issue. We've heard nothing from him and certainly no solutions.
Mr. Coulton has also said that certain industries are now being unfairly blamed and whole sections of farming industries are being unfairly blamed for this issue. What do you have to say to that?
I would say that there are fantastic irrigators out there. There are irrigators who have done the right thing. They've sold water back. They're putting in efficiencies. They are doing more with less. But at the same time, there are some big corporate irrigators, especially in the northern part of New South Wales and in the southern part of Queensland, who are just going hell for leather and doing whatever we want. We saw that with the scandal of the water theft. And for Mark Coulton to pretend that big corporate cotton isn't destroying the Darling River, well, he's a fool.
That's Jeremy Buckingham and making his point on that management of the river system. Now, we spoke to the Minister Coulton a short time ago. He was very kind to call us from India, and it was just before the country hour, so I apologise to him. We actually lost that audio. But the point he's making there about Jeremy Buckingham's argument about mismanagement is that it's a bit rich for the Greens to be arguing against the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. That actually is the tool for rescuing the environment right along the river system. And he had a couple of other points as well. So my apologies, I wasn't able to bring you that audio from Mark Coulton. On the country hour, though, it's 3 minutes to one. Time for the markets. And first to the Wagga lamb sale, Leanne Dax.
On council advice to hold lambs back due to the extreme heat temperatures, numbers fell away to only 16,000 lambs and 8,000 sheep. The yarding lacked weight and quality was quite mixed. Despite a smaller contingent of buyers operating, prices for trade lambs to $2 to $6, while heavy lambs were unchanged. Light trade, $124 to $140. Medium trade, $142 to $158. Heavy trade, $153 to $168, averaging 663 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy lambs, $160 to $176. The extra heavies, $171 to $217, averaging 642 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Lambs back to the paddock, $71 to $123. Lambs to feed on, topped at $152. Light sheep trail, $11. Trade sheep were back 6 to 10, making from $66 to $115. While heavy mutt knees back 4, 112 to 173. I'm Leanne Dax, MLA.
David Monk is at the Dubbo Cattle Sale.
Good afternoon. With the cheaper markets throughout the week, combined with the very hot conditions, numbers were down by 425 for a yarding of 3,075. Cows made up a large percentage of the yarding, along with good numbers of yearlings, which were mostly suitable for the feeders and restockers. There were only a few pens of properly finished ground steers yarded. Not all the regular buyers were operating, resulting in a cheaper market. Young cattle of a trade were 15 cents cheaper, with the prime steer yearling selling from 248 to 270. Feeder cattle were 20 to 25 cents cheaper, with the feeder steers selling from 224 to 286. The feeder heifers sold from 184 to 255. Young restocker cattle were 10 to 20 cents cheaper, with the young steers selling from 188 to 269, while the young restocker heifers sold from 150 to 208. Ground steers were considerably cheaper, with quality a factor. The prime, medium and heavyweight sold from 231 to 260. Cows were 22 cents cheaper. The two scores sold from 110 to 163, while the better three and four scores sold from 150 to 199, with the prime heavyweights averaging 196. Bulls sold to 225. This is David Monk in Dubbo for MLA.
And finally to the Armidale Cattle Sale, James Armitage.
Good afternoon. Hot, dry weather forced increased numbers onto the market. 1,700 pen, a large supply of cows with yearlings and veelers well supplied. Quieting condition was very mixed, plenty of plain conditioned cattle and a few well-finished lines. Cheaper trends throughout, with demand from restockers fairly subdued. Feedlotters putting a floor in the market for suitable cattle. Lightweight weaner steers to restockers 25 cents cheaper and more in places, ranging from 220 to 300 cents a kilo. Heifer veelers were firm to cheaper, 157 to 234. Yearling steers 14 to 20 cents cheaper and more for quality and places. Lightweights to restock and feed 110 to 258 C&D muscles. Medium and heavy feeders 230 to 283. All but the very best quality yearling heifers suffered significant price reduction. C&D muscle lightweights 112 to 254. Medium and heavy feeders 180 to 261. Heavy ground steers 260 to 270. One and two score cows 57 to 150 cents, with 3 and 4 schools 133 to 192 cents a kilo. James Armitage, Brownell A.